It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the coronavirus pandemic is a top public health issue, and it's making other long-term issues worse, including the opioid epidemic. A Wisconsin doctor tells us about the new challenges facing efforts to prevent and treat addiction.
First, we've been checking in with some well-loved authors in the state about what they've been reading and how they've been spending their time during this pandemic.
Chloe Benjamin, the author of two novels, Anatomy of Dreams and The Immortalist, joins us now. She lives in Madison.
And we want to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. What have you been reading lately? Have you been returning to previous favorites or enjoying something new and unexpected? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Chloe Benjamin joins us now. Chloe, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I am thrilled to be here.
Well, I've been perusing, I should say, your reading list from the last couple of years. You read a lot, even in a normal year. Has 2020, though, been a time to hunker down and do even more reading maybe than usual for you?
I think it has. You know, 2020 has been this bizarre mixed experience for those of us who are lucky enough to work from home, in that you both have more time and you're incredibly distracted. So I think reading has been a really important way for me to kind of imaginatively escape for a few hours from our world, but also to engage with our world.
Before we dig into some of your reading lists, I know a lot of people have found a variety of hobbies to get into this year. Have you done some of that outside of reading?
Well, I'm a huge knitter. So I have been knitting up a storm, although I do that every year. And I also have taken up dance. There's a virtual dance teacher who I subscribe to. Her name is Melody, and the company is Melody Dance Fit. I swear this is not sponsored. But she has just such a fantastic attitude about, it's not about the steps. Don't worry about that. Shed stress. Have fun. Release something. And I've found moving my body and being in my body to be really healing this year.
I've asked a couple other writers about this. How is it affecting you as a writer during this pandemic year? The answers I've gotten from some other writers have been mixed. There are ups and downsides here. What's been your experience?
Well, I've had an interesting one. The book that I started working on after The Immortalists, I began in 2016, but early in the year prior to the presidential election. And I'm pretty tight-lipped about my projects because I don't like to talk about them until I know I can pull them off. But I will say that that one was an alternate history that ended in 2020, or would end in 2020. And I did not expect so much about 2020. And it really has thrown me, because I was struggling to write essentially an alternate history in real time in circumstances that I certainly haven't processed yet. And I don't think any of us have. So I actually set that novel in a drawer, as we call it, and I started working on something else. And it is super scary. I feel a lot of grief about setting that book aside, since it has been my life for the past 4 years. But I'm also trying to go with inspiration and accept that, you know, my writing life and my output is going to change because of what we're going through.
We're talking to novelist Chloe Benjamin, based in Madison. She's here to share some reading suggestions for the time of pandemic. And you can join in with your own suggestions. What have you been turning to in 2020? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Chloe, just looking at your list overall, a lot of variety, new books, old books, heavy books, lighter reads. Is that key to your reading success, having just a nice mix?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I read a lot of contemporary fiction because that's the genre that I'm writing in, or contemporary literary fiction. And I want to support other writers and, you know what's coming out at the moment. But it's also important for me to not lose track of, you know, books that I've been meaning to read but haven't yet. So, for instance, I read Love in the Time of Cholera by Gabriel Garcia Marquez this year, and it was the first time I had read him, and I had just felt terribly remiss about that for a long time. So I try to mix it up and sort of play.
I have a problem sometimes with that kind of should reads, books that I somehow have made it to this point and never read. And I don't know, it almost feels like it's a chore to do it. Did you find it, or did you get into it and find it to be enjoyable to read?
I did get into it, but I always feel that people should feel free to stop reading a book if they are not enjoying it, because there are just too many books to read in the world. So I tend to give myself 50 pages, and if it's just not hitting for me, then I say my attention can be better devoted to something else, and I'm just not the right reader. So let go of the guilt. That's what I say.
All right, well, let's start naming some more names now. I'm looking at your list. I should start with Ann Patchett and The Dutch House. She came on for a similar conversation around the time The Dutch House came out. Talk about Ann Patchett and The Dutch House on your list.
Oh, yeah. Well, The Dutch House, I read very early this year, and Ann Patchett is just wonderful. I think she has such a beautiful style and psychological acuity, and I love sibling stories. I love family stories, so that book was really a treat to dive into.
Who are some of the other authors coming out with books this year, or at least pretty fresh, 2019, who you've read and are recommending to people?
Well, one book that I am currently reading is a novel called Catherine House. This is by a debut writer named Elizabeth Thomas, and it's a fun escapist read because it's really a delicious gothic novel, and it follows a young woman who goes to a secretive 3-year quasi-college in which students are not allowed to leave the gates, and questionable scientific research may be going on. So it's really diverse, and it brings a modern sensibility to the genre. Good for cozy November 2020. What month are we in? Good
sure.
For cozy November evenings.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Teresa with us in Bayview. Teresa, hi.
Hi. I just want to congratulate you, Chloe. Your story, The Immortalist, is amazing. And I love that you are in Madison, my alma mater. But your detail is just phenomenal from coming from the West Coast.
Yeah. Did you want to ask for any recommendations from Chloe, Teresa?
Yes. Anything that you would recommend that's somewhat similar to that book, I would love to get into.
All right, Teresa.
Oh.
Thanks, Chloe. Teresa likes Chloe Benjamin. Who would you point her toward?
Well, Teresa, thank you so much. I'm incredibly touched by your kind words and thrilled that the novel resonated with you. I actually have a great list of books that I kind of see as sister books to The Immortalist. Some I read before I wrote it and some I read afterward. But here's just a few. The Interestings by Meg Wolitzer is about a group of kids who grow up wanting to be artists, and it follows them over many decades. Rebecca Mackay's The Great Believers is an incredible epic that has to do with the AIDS epidemic, and I just thought it was marvelous. Pachinko by Min Jin Lee is a family story that is set over multiple generations. And all of these books have a lot of heart and beautiful prose, so I hope you like them.
Thanks so much for that call, Teresa, at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Peter now with us in Viroqua. Peter, hi.
Hi. I'm sorry, Chloe, that I haven't read you, but hearing you speak makes me want to. So I'm going to, your book is what, The Immortals?
The Immortalists.
Yeah. So I'll look that one up and dig into it. But I wanted to mention that one of the just blessings of being a parent when my children got older, I have two sons, 19 and 16, and my oldest son recommended Patrick Rothfuss, The Name of the Wind, and then the sequel, The Wise Man's Fear. And I was sort of reticent to read them, and, one's like 670 pages and the other's like 1,000 or whatever, And I got into them, and thanks to my son, I just had this amazing read, and this is another Wisconsin author. So thanks for being on the show, and I'll look forward to reading your book.
Peter, thanks a lot for the call. Peter recommending Wisconsin's own Patrick Rothfuss. Do you find yourself seeking out, Chloe, people who are local to the area or to the state?
Well, that's always just a wonderful bonus. I think, you know, Wisconsin has a really incredible arts community, and Madison, where I did my MFA, has so many wonderful writers who live in town. So now, of course, that I'm on the spot, my mind is blanking. But actually, I can tell you one book that I absolutely loved was written by Judith Clare Mitchell. She was actually my graduate school mentor, and she's also an incredible writer. And this book follows three sisters who are writing a joint suicide note on the last day of the 20th century. And it's funny.
Wow.
So you might not think so, but that's a really fantastic one.
Peter, thanks for calling in. We're talking to author Chloe Benjamin, Madison-based author of The Anatomy of Dreams and The Immortalists. We're sharing some great book recommendations.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Chloe? What have you been reading lately? Maybe you've got some things on your list or want some additional recommendations. Give us a call, 800-642-1234.
You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network, I'm Keely Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up the conversation with Madison-based author Chloe Benjamin. She's the author of the novels Anatomy of Dreams and The Immortalists.
And we want to hear from you. The number to call is 800-642-1234. What's on your reading list for the rest of 2020? Tell us what you're reading or something you've enjoyed so far. You can do that at 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Let's go back to our callers now. Sandy is with us in New Berlin. Sandy, hi.
Hi. I'm calling about a book that I just finished yesterday that I was so thrilled that I had read. It's by Isabel Wilkerson. She wrote The Warmth of Other Suns, The Great Migration, you know, and kind of taught the whole country about what that was. I think she won a Pulitzer for that, but I could be wrong. Anyway, so this her new book is Cast. C-A-S-T-E. And it is, I'm looking at the cover here now, The Origins of Our Discontent. So she explains, what she really does is explain how our culture and our society is organized. And it's a very hard thing to see when you're in the middle of it. But she is such a good writer and just makes it a pleasure to read. And she does it in all different ways. She does personal narrative. She does essays. She does research reporting. It's just excellent.
Thank you so much for the suggestion. I appreciate it. Do you have, Chloe, nonfiction or essay on your radar?
Ooh, I do. I am currently reading Underland by Robert McFarlane, and it's essentially a book about underground spaces. So there's a section on the catacombs in Paris. There's a section on sea caves, on a mine, a former mine in South Dakota, in which scientists are trying to find cosmic particles. So it's really fascinating, and I would highly recommend it to anyone this year.
Thanks again, Sandy, for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to get to some more frequently appearing names on your reading list. Tana French, I see you've got a 2020 book, The Witch Elm, but if I scroll down into your reading history, she pops up a lot. Tell us about her.
Yeah, I do love Tana French. So she is a crime writer, and she lives in Ireland. I believe that she's actually American, but she writes beautiful crime novels that are set in Ireland. And, you know, being a writer, I love a good plot, but the language also has to be there for me to truly become attached to a book. And she's just a beautiful writer and a brilliant plotter. And her books focus on a squad of detectives in what it's called the Dublin Murder Squad. And so each book takes place from the perspective of a different person on the squad. So it's a lot of fun to see how those relationships play out as well.
And I'll say I read one of her books set in Dublin, as you say, and I'm not always a crime and police procedural kind of reader. And I really liked it. She does have a way with telling the story beyond just the plot, as you said.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then who else? Let's see. How about rereading? I know I think some of your books you go back and reread from time to time. What does it take for a book to get a second look from you?
You know, that's a great question. And I think in part it comes down to atmosphere. If I'm going to read a book for a second or third time, it's because I want to live in that world. So some of the books that I reread are actually ones that inspired me as a young person. I've been rereading the Harry Potter series, but also one of my favorite books of all time or series of all time is Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy. I read that when I was 13 for the first time, and it still impacts me just as much today. It's about consciousness and religion and the cosmos and knowledge. And they're the kind of young adult books that translate just as powerfully to adults. So I've been rereading those books in anticipation of his new trilogy, which also takes place in the same universe. So for any fantasy lovers, Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials and the new trilogy, The Book of Dust, is just fantastic.
I'm sometimes a little nervous to go back to a cherished childhood read memory in case it doesn't hold up and it kind of ruins it for me. It sounds like that's not the experience you've had, at least with that series.
No, you know, and I think that's when you really know that a book is truly special to you. Another book actually that I reread this year was A Wrinkle in Time. And I bet a lot of readers will recognize that when it was published in the 60s. And it speaks just as powerfully to me today as, you know, it did in its time. So that's, again, you know, a young adult book, but one that I think really transcends age and all kinds of other boundaries.
We are talking to Madison-based novelist Chloe Benjamin, author of Anatomy of Dreams and The Immortalist. She's sharing some great reading suggestions for us for a pandemic time or any other time. Still time for you to sneak in your own recommendation at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can find some good recommendations from our listeners while you're over there. Another name on your list, I've read some of her older books, not her newest ones, I think, Emily St. John Mandel.
Oh, yeah. I love her writing. So she's best known for Station 11, which came out in 2014, but that was actually her fourth book. And I love her story because it reminds me a little bit of mine in that my first book was what we call a quieter publication. It didn't reach as wide of an audience as my second book. And so I kind of feel a kinship when authors have a book that reaches that wide audience, but not their debut. But beyond that, I just find her to be somebody whose, I mean, language is absolutely beautiful, and her plotting is also brilliant. Her first three books are actually kind of in the noir category, and then Station 11 and her most recent book, The Glass Hotel, move into kind of literary fiction with a speculative component.
Yeah, what's up? What's The Glass Hotel about? I'm interested in reading it. I have not checked it out myself because I really enjoyed Station 11 and then went back and read some of her earlier ones.
So The Glass Hotel is essentially about a young woman who kind of becomes a drifter, takes on a number of different jobs and kind of moves through a sort of underworld, and then meets a very, very wealthy man who turns out to be running a Ponzi scheme. And this is not giving away anything because I'm pretty sure this is on the jacket of the book, but it essentially is, you know, moves back and forth in time through their relationship before, during, and after the collapse of the scheme. So it has a lot to do with money, which I think, you know, literary fiction doesn't talk about enough, or, you know, people don't write it about enough. But she just brings her just a real humanity and compassion to everybody that she writes, even if the characters are doing terrible things.
Now, here's one on your list this year that's kind of a kid doing his own thing here. George Bernard Shaw, Saint Joan, his take on the Joan of Arc tale. How did that one find its way into your list this year?
You know, I read that for research for the book that I had been working on that I set aside, but I'm still glad that I did because it was a great read. And a fun personal connection is that my mom, who is a stage actor, actually played Joan of Arc when she was young. And so I was able to ask her about her experience of that show. And one thing that she told me is that she would rehearse bound and so that she had the experience of imprisonment in her body. So so that was just a really neat layer as I was reading that play.
Now, what is on your stack, your to-read stack? You probably can't recommend quite yet, but you're excited to crack open when you're done with your current reads.
Yeah. You know, there's a book that I would actually wanted to bring up because it's called The Power of Ritual, Turning Everyday Activities into Soulful Practices. It's by Casper Terkile, who is a Harvard Divinity School fellow, and he's also a co-host of a podcast called Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. And the idea behind this book is turning, you know, these everyday actions like walking the dog or pouring yourself a cup of coffee or smelling a scent can be made sacred and can connect you to a spirituality that doesn't have to rely on an organized religion or a church. And I don't think it's a book that pushes away those things, but it just imagines a kind of sacredness of the everyday. And I think that just really resonated with me during this time when we feel pretty isolated. Many of us are in our homes. So I'm really looking forward to reading that.
That sounds like a great book for this time and a good place to leave it. Chloe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
That was Chloe Benjamin, author of two novels, Anatomy of Dreams and The Immortalists. She lives in Madison, and she joined us to talk about what she's been reading during the pandemic. And you can keep sharing your own book recommendations. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, the opioid epidemic is a major public health challenge, and it's getting worse as we try to contain COVID-19. We'll get the latest on addiction in Wisconsin. I'm Keely Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, a civil rights attorney recaps Election Day, how the vote went and what issues emerged as Americans cast millions of ballots. It's all part of our continued election coverage tomorrow here on the Ideas Network.
Now, before coronavirus hit, opioids were widely viewed as one of the nation's top public health crises.
According to the American Medical Association, more than 40 states have recorded increases in opioid-related deaths since the start of the pandemic.
Meanwhile, lawsuits against drug manufacturing companies continue making their way through the courts, like the recently settled Purdue Pharma lawsuit.
The company pleaded guilty to 3 felonies and agreed to an $8 billion settlement for the aggressive marketing of the drugs that help fuel this.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the opioid crisis? How do you think treating the crisis has been impacted by COVID-19? If you have a personal story to share with us, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
Dr. Chris Eberline is an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse. Dr. Eberline, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me today.
As an emergency room doctor, what have you seen change in the last months related to the opioid crisis?
You know, it's been a pretty challenging 6-8 months, as we all know, for multiple reasons. But what we've seen in the emergency departments is, at least locally, we had been doing fairly well at reducing our opiate deaths in the county of La Crosse. In fact, we had a high of 29 approximately 4 years ago, and we had steadily dropped that down to 22, and we'd completely eliminated deaths from prescription opiate drugs. And this year, early on, we saw that really basically do a 180, and already this year we're past where we were at the highest that we were in the past, with 32 deaths already year to date. So it's been a pretty challenging year, and I think it's been frustrating for a lot of those on the front lines that saw some progress made and then saw the decline.
So what's happening that things have changed?
Well, I really think it's started off with the social isolation, and you've got a vulnerable population to begin with those with substance use disorder. And a lot of them have confounding mental health issues, things like that. And so what we saw was they were not either canceling appointments, having appointments canceled, or not going in and getting their routine mental health. So I think that was a big factor. And then they lost some of their social supports. And then when you couple that with economic trouble and everything else that came with the pandemic, and especially the uncertainty, I think it really drove a lot of them to use more, unfortunately.
Yeah. How does that limiting of contact with other people really affect someone who has a history of addiction or who has been struggling with drug use?
Yeah, I think that's just huge because they really need that social support. The times they're thinking of using, they'd have someone to go visit or talk to and things like that. And that loss of social support, I think, was a huge impact on these patients.
How should we think about COVID-19 as a pandemic and the opioid crisis as an epidemic? Is our focus on COVID-19 taking away from our focus on opioids? Is it being overshadowed, or is it not really a contentious relationship? Where do you see it?
I see it as a complicated relationship. You had initially early on, I think there was, we didn't really know how to handle the outpatient visits, and all the telehealth components weren't really in place. And so as we've transitioned, I think we've been able to shift focus back. But early on, truly, I think the focus was shifted towards COVID-19. And quite frankly, I think that was initially on was appropriate because we didn't know exactly what we were dealing with at the time. But as time has gone on and we've kind of worked out some of the glitches in the telehealth and getting appointments back online, our shift, we're finding out we're able to deal with both at once.
Mm. Dr. Chris Eberlein is an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse, and we are talking about the opioid epidemic and how it relates to COVID-19 and what's still happening in our country when it comes to prescription drugs. You are listening to the Ideas Network, and you can call in to join this conversation. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We've got Rick from Eau Claire ready to join the conversation. Hi, Rick. All right. It looks like we missed Rick, but Rick's question is, with the recent crackdown on doctors prescribing opioids, then where are they coming from? Dr. Eberlein.
Well, I think what you've seen is, we've had two major fentanyl busts in La Crosse County. In fact, between the two of them, it was enough to overdose about 200,000 people. So we are seeing a substantial increase in the illicit drug trade. Our prescription drug numbers, there has been a slight trend to larger prescriptions, and I think that was in part because it was more difficult to get appointments. So, but by far and large, the majority of deaths that we're seeing is secondary to the illicit drug trade.
And let's take just a step back then. When you mentioned fentanyl, we're seeing it come up because people think that they have heroin or they have purchased heroin, and really it's fentanyl, which is extremely deadly.
That's correct. Yep. In fact, and unfortunately, I think some people now, I've heard they're actually marketing it sometimes as fentanyl, but by far and large, the majority of people are looking for IV heroin. And the trick there is fentanyl is about 1,000 times stronger than heroin. So it's very difficult to weigh out and to get the proper, to get a non-lethal dose.
As winter approaches, there are lots of people who are going to be dealing with seasonal depression or even additional mental health problems related to pandemic stress, as you mentioned. Do you think that factors into what we're seeing right now and what we might see this winter?
I absolutely do. I think this is going to be something that we're going to be this is going to be an ongoing struggle for patients that have mental health problems. And I really encourage them to reach out and get the help that they need, because it is there. It's in the communities, and it should be as easy to get now than it was in the past, but they have to make the first step and reach out.
Yeah, and we've rooted this conversation in discussion of opioids, you know, which is an addiction, which is a physical addiction. You're talking a lot about mental health. Is addiction also a mental health issue? And how do we deal with all of those factors at the same time?
Absolutely. This is addiction is a very complicated disease. You've got mental health undertones with physical addiction. So all components really have to be dealt with to have a successful treatment. And those patients are complicated patients, and you know, the pandemic has been very hard on them.
I want to go to Bo in Waukesha now. Bo, thanks for the call.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, I'm just listening. I'm an addict in recovery myself, and you know, there is a lot of stuff out there right now, despite, you know, the resources that have been either complicated or have been taken away. You know, I've stayed clean through this, and I know a lot of people have, but it has been, a lot of people close to me pass away during this time too. I know it's been very hard, but you know, there's a lot of stuff online, like there's a lot of Zoom meetings. You know, I can get on a meeting any time of the day or night, anywhere in the world right now. And that's been available this whole time. And it's been great, you know. And, you know, it only takes two people to have a meeting. You know, anybody can get together. You know, you don't have to go to an actual meeting or a place where they hold it. You know, you can facilitate one yourself. You know, all of our literature, all of the literature is online. And, you know, I won't speak directly what program I'm in exactly, but there's a lot of things available. You know, there's a lot of call-ins too, so you can call and get on a meeting as well. So people know that, you know, you can get online.
Bo, thank you so much for sharing your story with us, and best of luck in your recovery. We really appreciate you being willing to talk with us about that. And Dr. Eberlein, what I hear Bo saying is, yes, it's really hard, and maybe there are some opportunities where things are now more accessible to people than they might be have been if we hadn't had a pandemic and realized there's a need for this telehealth.
Yeah, you know, I think some of that is true. And, you know, and I really do support and appreciate his insight on that, because a lot of people have reached out to, you know, telehealth and Zoom meetings and, you know, WebEx, all these other different platforms and make connections. And I really encourage people to keep doing that. There is always that subset of patients that are left behind that don't have access to such technology. And so we're also really working hard locally to try and figure out how to connect with them once again as well.
We're talking with Dr. Chris Eberlein, an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the ongoing opioid crisis? Are you a service provider or someone who, like our caller, has needed services to help deal with addiction? What is working for you in 2020 in finding or providing treatment? Call in with your thoughts, your stories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org.
This conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina. Right now, we're talking with Dr. Chris Eberlein. He's an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse. And we're talking about the opioid epidemic. And there's room for you in this conversation. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. What question do you have about what's happening when it comes to the opioid crisis? Maybe you have a story you'd like to share. 800-642-1234. And we have Cal from Madison ready for this conversation. Hi, Cal.
Well, hi. How are you? Thanks for taking my call. And I think this is an absolutely important topic to have on. It's good to hear it. So I just have a concern for me. I've been in the recovery community for almost 40 years, and I have a really strong established network. Anywhere I go, I feel comfortable with that. But the main issue that I see in the that I have the most trouble with is that the person who's seeking help right now has no way of finding it or very little way of finding it. And people who are seeking help are in a situation where they don't have access to internet or aren't in a state of mind that really would lend to them figuring out how to use those resources that are available. They're mostly fairly desperate and, confused and so forth. So it's a situation that is continuing, and we don't have answers. I don't have answers for it. I've been trying to find a way to, make these contacts myself, and other than references through the community, which I always get, there's just not much way to, to contact those folks or to maintain or create a contact for them,
Yeah, Cal, thank you so much for talking about this aspect of it. Dr. Eberlein, what should someone do if they're in the position where they feel like they need help, but there are so many restrictions now and it's just not as easy?
Yeah, and that is the thing that we really struggled with early on. But as Bo alluded to, I think that now that we've got more e-visits going, and there is more opportunities have opened up. We were looking locally just a week ago at our Alliance to Heal and looking at the opportunities, and we have expanded our providers and counselors and across the entire spectrum of treatment. We're at the best place we've ever been. So really encourage these patients to reach out, contact their county, contact their local. Most counties now have some sort of, our Alliance to Heal is an example in La Crosse, where it's a group of community members. We've got a website, and if you don't have access to a computer, you can go to the library and use that. The resources are there, and we're really working at pushing these resources out to the vulnerable community members. We've started a program in our ambulance service, Tri-State Ambulance, whereas if someone overdoses prior to this, when they refuse to go to the hospital, which often happens about 25% of the time, and you miss the opportunity to intervene, we were just giving them a small amount of resources. Well, now we put together an overdose safety kit that includes Narcan, pocket mask for rescue breathing, and a 17-page document that they that's left at the scene with them on all the resources in the community so they can reach out and get help. And that's just one of the examples of the things that we're really trying to spread throughout the community, both Narcan and all the resources that are available.
We've seen some news reports from other places where a COVID test has been required to be treated or to be seen for addiction. I mean, that could take days. What is the situation here?
Yeah, here, this is where those electronic visits would really fit in because you can make that initial contact virtually. You don't have to worry about the COVID testing then. And so I think that is going to be a key component going forward to making sure that we continue to get, support for those electronic visits.
Yeah. We've got Laura in Beaver Dam ready to talk with us. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I have a family member that's addicted, and it's been probably everything under the spectrum that we've been on and off. I want to know what is the first step to try to get them into treatment, to talk them into it, or how can I help her?
Laura, thank you so much for being willing to ask that question. Dr. Eberlein, where can Laura start?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for reaching out on your loved one's behalf. I think you've already made the first start by being there to listen to the person that's addicted. Oftentimes, it's a matter of just having someone they know they can trust to be able to talk to, and then to help guide them to look for alternatives for treatment. There are a lot of, unfortunately, with addiction, it's often, the one shoe doesn't fit all. There's lots of different routes to sobriety here, and you really have to work with that individual patient and finding something that works for them. But the most important thing is having them have someone that they trust that they can talk to.
And also, if Laura is worried about this person, it sounds like, maybe there's an opportunity for Laura to kind of care for herself, too. Is that fair, Dr. Eberlein?
For sure. Yeah, you always have to take care to work at, you know, if you're really worried about someone, you bring them in the emergency department, bring them into their family doctor, physically bring them there and tell them your concerns. Sometimes you just really have to really be an advocate for that family member, because oftentimes they're reluctant, they're nervous about it. They've been stigmatized in the past, perhaps, and so they don't feel so comfortable going in and asking for help.
Yeah. Dr. Chris Eberlein is an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse, and we are talking about the opioid epidemic. We've got John from Black River Falls on the line. Hey, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if you're seeing an upscale in abuse in program like for Suboxone programs and other programs of that nature. And if you are, is that attributing to the purchase of the illicit drugs out on the streets?
Thanks for the question, John. And John also mentioned Suboxone. So, Dr. Eberlein, go ahead.
Sure. So locally, we have not seen the medication-assisted treatments be a driving force in our increase in deaths. And so we have not seen that locally. I don't know about statewide. So locally, that hasn't been a problem, fortunately. Most of the deaths that we're seeing are secondary to fentanyl. And we've had pretty good success with our medication-assisted treatments locally.
Because Suboxone is one of the drugs that you can use to help treat opioid addiction.
That is correct.
Just last month, the Justice Department announced a settlement of $8 billion with Purdue Pharma, really for this aggressive marketing that helped fuel the prescription opioid epidemic from the beginning. Are we still seeing high levels of opioids prescribed?
We've seen a dramatic decrease in prescriptions. In fact, it's pretty profound when you review the data. I mean, we're talking over 50% now statewide since this began. So the providers with the provider education and the PDMP, those are the two things that really made an impact. And so that was directly correlated to our decrease in overdose deaths due to prescriptions locally and statewide as well.
What does that do for people who really do need the opioid prescriptions? How has that changed their lives or their relationship with doctors who prescribe them?
So that is a challenging aspect. There will always be patients that obviously require these drugs. These drugs are important in the treatment of many diseases. And there's no doubt they were overprescribed before for a lot of things that weren't necessary. But we also have to be careful the pendulum doesn't swing too far, that we're not treating patients that really need these medications.
Well, I mean, the American Medical Association has been advocating for more flexibility when it comes to providing medicine and care for patients with opioid use. Is that something you're practicing at your clinic?
For sure. Yeah. Every patient is treated as an individual, and you really have to find the best course of treatment for that patient.
Okay. And sometimes that requires some flexibility. Like what might you see?
Well, you may see, longer and higher dosing of certain medications. Referrals to other types of providers is also important when you're looking for alternatives to the patient's pain. That is one thing that I think that we really missed in the past is looking at, it was real easy to prescribe a medication, and it was more time consuming and often more difficult for the patient to commit to those 20 physical therapy appointments or commit to the chiropractor, acupuncture. I mean, there's the whole gauntlet of alternative therapies out there that can help these patients.
Yeah. Dr. Eberlein, I want to say thank you so much for being here with us. As we wrap up, that was Dr. Chris Eberlein, an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse, and he joined us to talk about what's happening in our state with the opioid epidemic.
Join us tomorrow on Central Time for coverage of election results. Elections have always been tough. They've never been a piece of cake. But once upon a time in the United States on Election Day, you could probably count on eating a piece of cake.
Yeah, it turns out that there was an American tradition of making and serving cakes on Election Day in the early days of our republic.
According to a piece at historians.org, election cake was a way for more people to participate in the hubbub of Election Day when not many people actually got to vote.
Okay, I love this idea of cake, but the downside was it was fruitcake. I mean, one recipe was meant for baking in bulk, and it took 30 quarts of flour, 10 pounds of butter, 14 pounds of sugar, 12 pounds of raisins, a dozen eggs, and listen, lots and lots of wine, brandy, spices, and fruit.
Yeah, I think if I was going to go for an Election Day cake, which I think I'm actually a little late on now, I didn't make one, it would probably not be a fruit cake. Maybe a good chocolate cake? I don't know. Where would you go, Keely?
You know, I probably would go with a white cake because then you could dye the different layers different colors, and I am a sucker for a theme.
Okay. That's where I'd election-themed colored white cake. Interesting. But yeah, fruitcake, let's save that for the holidays coming up, the traditional passing of the fruitcakes from one person to another.
It has a place, and it's not Election Day. That's what I'm saying.
Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.